And thank you, Danny, for the reading of God's Word. Good evening tonight. Glad to see you here this evening for our worship time together as a body of believers in this place. I guess we're just all at different places at different times. And for one person's experience is different from another person's experience. But I must say tonight, I don't know what it is, but to me, the song we sang wasn't just a song. It felt like there's a sweet, sweet spirit in here tonight, that's a beautiful thing. I don't know. I appreciate Andrew so much for the selection of songs and the way that he led them and the way that you've participated. It just really just seemed to, it stirred my spirit tonight as we worship God, and I hope it did yours too. Really thankful that you're here tonight. For our worship time together. We are going to be looking at 1 Corinthians 15 in the passage that was just read. So if you weren't looking at that when Danny read it, you may want to open your Bible there now, or your app, or your smartphone, or whatever the case may be, to 1 Corinthians 15, verses 42 to 49. We're going to look at that particular paragraph in a much longer discussion of the Apostle Paul on the issue of the resurrection. And so that's what we'll be looking at tonight. I think the best way that I know to get started, and here's a danger with sermon illustrations. The purpose of a sermon illustration, and this is, I must say to you, it's kind of frustrating sometimes as a preacher, because you'll preach a sermon, sometimes you'll be real excited about the sermon and the point that you're making about the sermon, and in an effort to help people see the point, the spiritual point, You'll give an illustration that lays aside of that spiritual point to help illuminate it and bring it into reality and awareness. And then you get done with the sermon, and then people are talking to you in the foyer at the end, and all they want to talk about is the illustration. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I had a dog like that too one time. And then they launch into a 15-minute story. I'm not pointing any fingers, but you know, and you're like, okay, I appreciate that, but did you hear the point? Did you hear the point? That's the danger of sermon illustrations. It's particularly the danger of sermon illustrations whenever you draw an illustration from popular culture. Because you draw an illustration from popular culture because it really resonates, it really makes the point. But sometimes you don't want to come across as if you're endorsing that thing that you're using as an illustration. That's the case tonight. I will say to you right up front, the illustration I'm going to start with tonight is an illustration from popular culture. It's an illustration from a movie, and I have not seen this movie, nor do I recommend that anyone see this movie. I looked at online and noticed that the movie is rated R, and for good reason, so I don't necessarily endorse this movie, and I've not seen the movie itself, but in preparation for the sermon this week, I ran across this illustration that someone else had written that had seen the movie, and I thought, man, that is powerful. And it's the best way to start the sermon tonight. So I'm going to share it with you, this particular part. There's an award-winning film called The Joy Luck Club. And the story is about a little girl who has the capacity, and this is her own words, to be able to see the secrets of a chessboard. And she has this special gift that enables her to be able to actually be highly successful at playing chess to the point of becoming the national chess champion by age 8. Now, the only problem that this girl had, she had unlimited possibility and talent. Her only liability was in her driven mother, who really was envious of her daughter's gifts and abilities and sought to basically selfishly use her daughter's gifts and abilities for her own ambition, wealth, and power. And so at one point, the girl gets really frustrated with her mother in the movie, and she kind of talks back to her mother, to which her mother, after being quiet for a moment, then responds with these words, "You are nothing. You are nothing at all." And what is so insightful is the girl then explains what happened to her after that statement from there on out. And this is what she said. "What she said to me was like a curse. This power I had, this belief in what I had been given, that I could actually feel that power draining away. I could feel myself becoming so ordinary. And all the secrets that I once saw, I couldn't see anymore. All I could see were my mistakes and my weaknesses and the best part of me disappeared. Do you realize how much power that you have over the people around you? By the words you use, you can speak life into someone, or you can absolutely take the best part of them away forever by a statement of criticism and discouragement. You see, our critical words of others, I think so masterfully illustrated by this story, our critical words toward other people have the ability to rob people of their passion. People that once had unlimited possibilities and abilities and enthusiasm and excitement for a good cause, feeling their gifting, that can all be taken away when their spirits are quenched, their heart is squashed by just even the simplest of discouraging words. You know, I think as Christians, we know the standard to which we've been called. We see Jesus as that supreme example of goodness and morality. And we know, as His followers, that we're called to emulate that. And because we as a body of believers have this high standard, which we should have, sometimes if we're not careful, we can fall into the trap of becoming extremely critical people. Critical of each other, critical of the church, critical of our culture, critical of our neighbors, just critical, critical, critical. And before you know it, and you may not even realize the pace at which it happens, you can become a person that really is kind of a killjoy, and you take the spirit out of everyone that you're around and destroy the best part of people from seeing their possibilities of what they could achieve and who they could become. We may not even realize how our behaviors and our words can actually drain life out of folks, but it also, on a positive turn of side of things, has the power to inspire people and make people see what they really are capable of and see the beauty of what could be. And it has a lot to do with what we say and how we say it. So our text is 1 Corinthians 15, and you're probably thinking to yourself, wow, where did you get that? From 1 Corinthians 15, 42 to 49. Well, I hope by tonight's end you'll see where it comes from. So Jesus is inviting us through inspiration of the Spirit. We're being invited into this passage, which basically is speaking to the reality that all of us as followers of Jesus have been invited into the resurrection life. A new way of living. A new type of attitude and behavior that not only has breathed new life into us, but we've been commissioned to go about breathing the resurrection life into others too. Now, let's get the context of what he's saying here in this paragraph. Paul, in this epistle, is writing to a group of Christians in the city of Corinth. And this church has got a lot of challenges. It's rather messed up, to be quite honest. They've got a lot of dysfunction, a lot of inner turmoil in the church. A lot of, even almost to the point of division, a lot of factions in the church. And there's a lot of problems going on. And so Paul writes this letter in an effort to encourage them and also instruct them and correct some things that need correcting in that church. Well, one of the things that we see as we read between the lines in the words of what Paul writes, clearly there were some people in this church in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 12, that actually denied the resurrection. the truth of the resurrection of the dead. Now, that's a pretty big deal, because the truth of the resurrection of the dead is one of the most foundational columns in the structure that is the belief system of the Christian faith. It all hinges, and Paul will make this argument at length in this chapter, it all hinges on the truth of the resurrection. Because if we don't really believe Jesus was raised from the dead, then what are we doing really? Because the whole Christian belief system is founded on that historical reality. And if Jesus was raised from the dead, it is implied and taught by Jesus, we shall follow him in his resurrection as his followers. But there were some believers that were denying the truthfulness of the resurrection, or some that were perhaps saying that it has already occurred and maybe you missed it. Well, in this chapter, Paul is giving us some really great instruction, and it's a lengthy argument, and there's a lot of great information in this chapter. I wish we had time to explore it all, but tonight I want us to focus primarily on this particular section. But in the chapter as a whole, Paul is giving a powerful defense about the truth of the resurrection, of how when Christ returns, all of those that are dead will be raised to live again. Now, in this part of his argument, he is explaining how that the physical body, the body that you and I now inhabit, that is a part of us, is a perishable body, a natural body, and he even says is a weak body. And we know that because of the ravages of sickness and illness and old age. We know that our bodies are deteriorating, these physical bodies. And so Paul compares it to like the physical body to like a seed that is sown in the ground, and it essentially seems to die. But from the death of that sown seed sprouts forth a new life that is more glorious than the first. And Paul terms it a spiritual body. So Paul is clear here that at the resurrection day, whenever Jesus returns, and he ushers in the new heavens and the new earth, a new environment of perfect dwelling of God and his people, we will exist in the new heavens and the new earth with new bodies, but spiritual in nature. Now, in order to make that point, Paul makes a bold contrast, and I hope you don't, I will tell you, let me just pause right here. I will tell you, this is the part in the sermon where it's going to be easy for me to lose some of you. Some of you are going to try to get off at this stop, and I don't want you to get off at this stop, because what Paul is saying right here is going to really mean a lot as we flesh it out. So if you can just hang on for about the next 3 to 5 minutes, then it's going to be a payoff, I promise. So in order to make his point, Paul contrasts the physical body and the resurrection body, the spiritual body, by talking about them in terms of the first Adam and the second Adam. You see that in verse number 45. The first Adam and the last Adam. Now, we need to explore that for just a second. Paul is reminding us by essentially quoting from Genesis chapter 2 and verse number 7 as to how we were originally made. The creator of the universe, God in heaven, came down into his created world, his created environment, and he scooped up a handful, so to speak, of dirt and created a man out of dust. But into that man of dust, the God of heaven breathed life into him. And he became animated. He became a living creature. So the man formed of dust came to life. And so Paul is calling us to reflect upon the reality of how we were made, the first Adam. But he's making clear that we should not just simply reflect the first Adam. Because being in the image of the first Adam is how most people live. Most of us live by no more than the traits of the first Adam. Here's what I mean by that. Most of us go about our lives simply maintaining, self-preserving, meeting our basic needs and desires. We live based on personal instinct, human reason, and our reactions. But God has something much more glorious in mind for me and you. He wants to ultimately recreate us. This time, rather than taking a handful of dust from the earth, God wants to scoop his hands across the powerful, sparkling matter that is the heavenly things, and scoop a handful of heavenly, whatever that is, and from that heavenly matter, create a heavenly person. Now, this will ultimately, he says, happen at the resurrection day, whenever we will be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, as he would say, we'll be in our glorified state. As John puts it in 1 John 2, we don't know what Jesus is now like exactly in his glorified state, in his resurrected state. But then we will see him and we will be like him. But now here's the point. Okay, so now I hope I didn't lose anybody along the way. The point is this. Paul is really driving home the point that although that's going to happen ultimately at the resurrection day, God's intention is that you and I conform our lives now to reflect the glorified state that we will eventually become. Now, what is that state? What is it like? He calls it the last Adam in verse 45. Now, what is the last Adam? The first Adam, of course, is the men and women being made originally, the physical bodies that we inhabit and our physical inclinations and tendencies. But the last Adam, Paul already spoke of earlier in the chapter in verses 21 through 22, and he talked of Jesus in terms of being the second Adam. Jesus is the glorified, perfect example of what humans were originally intended to be. But we fell in our sinful state. So rather than just simply living life like the first Adam, the last Adam doesn't just live, but instead lives for a specific purpose. And he tells us what the purpose is in a very seemingly cryptic phrase in verse 45. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. Those three words right there. A life-giving spirit. You see, the first Adam, now watch this carefully, the first Adam simply received life. The second Adam imparts life. The second Adam doesn't just have life breathed into him like the first Adam. The second Adam actually goes around breathing life into those around him or her. So following in the likeness of Jesus' resurrection means that we are on the pathway of the mission of the second Adam, and that is a mission of breathing life into all those around us. So the first Adam, of course, was made from the dust of the ground. Even though he had been made in God's image, the image was marred because he fell into sin, and this fallenness was demonstrated literally in the first Adam that was named Adam, the first man, because you see Adam and Eve had children. And that fallenness is demonstrated when Adam and Eve's son Cain murdered his brother Abel in Genesis chapter 4. And so Adam then fathered another child by the name of Seth. And Genesis 5 and verse 3 says that Adam passed his image on to his child Seth. Listen to what it says. When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. That's the first Adam. Our children, all of our children, have been born into physical worlds, into the physical world, with all of the physical limitations, with all the physical problems, with all the dysfunctions, with all of the sin, with all of the sadness. But as followers of Jesus, the second Adam, Christ wants to impart, just like the first Adam imparted his image to his child Seth, the second Adam, Christ, wants to impart his image into his children, his followers, into the believers of the Christ. He came to transform you and me away from the likeness of the first Adam and into the image of the second Adam, Jesus. So let's get right down to specifics then. If you're reflecting, or if I'm reflecting, the image of the first Adam, then you and I, we're just life-receiving people. We're just consumers of what others can do for us, what we can get out of life. We're just receiving life. Do you live your life just for yourself? Do people feel your critical spirit when you come around? When you enter a room, does it just like the air got sucked out of the room? Do you always look for, are you the kind of person that you can have a document in front of you, it has great, amazing, encouraging content, but immediately your eye is drawn to all the grammatical mistakes? Do you look for the things to correct? Are you the kind of person that in every situation, instead of seeing what's right, you see what's wrong about it? If so, you're reflecting the image of the first Adam. And I think we've all been there, if we're honest. Some of us a little more than others. You know, there's some people that just were weaned on lemons. And if you were to parse their life, they were born in the objective case and in the kickative mood. But when you or I are negative and critical and mean-spirited and bitter and angry and difficult and aggressive, that means that we're just reflecting the man of dust. And when we reflect the man of dust, all we end up doing is imparting mud to others. Or worse yet, death. Because the man of dust is always decaying and dying and coming to pieces. So Jesus has something more glorious. He wants to scoop up a handful of that heavenly, sparkly stuff, whatever that is, and reform you and me into the second Adam. And one of the most powerful ways that you and I can reflect the second Adam is by those three little words: to become a life-giving spirit. To impart life, breathe life. When we walk into a room, when we encounter others, we're breathing life, not taking it from them. Proverbs 18:21 speaks to this when it says, "The tongue, the words we use, has the power of life and of death." So if you're a life-giving spirit, that means that you're on a one-man, one-woman mission to speak positive, encouraging, uplifting words that breathe life into people. Rather than sucking the air out of the room, you choose words that will put the wind back in people's sails. You choose to see the good in people and overlook the bad, because love covers a multitude of sins. You look for reasons to see why we can succeed instead of looking for all the reasons why we're going to fail. You inspire people to be the best that they can be, to actually have the vision to see the best in themselves that maybe they can't even see yet, instead of bringing out the worst in them. You know, there's that old song, that old anthem that some have said is the anthem of the West, "Home on the Range, home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play. And there's that one line in the song that I think really reflects the kind of person that you and I should be if we're in the image of the second Adam, who is a life-giving spirit. We make our home a place where seldom is heard a discouraging word. Following Jesus means following the path of his death and the path of his resurrection. So I have to put to death my natural tendencies, the image of the first Adam, because he's made out of dust anyway, and to dust he's returning. So why not just give him an early funeral and then be raised to walk in the new life of the second Adam? Instead of just receiving life, be a person that goes and breathes life into all those around you. There's a song, many of you have heard it, that has been on the radio quite a bit. It's called Speak Life. I want to share just a few lines of that song because it really drives home this whole concept. Though it's crazy, amazing, we can turn a heart with the words we say. Mountains crumble with every syllable. Hope can live or die. Well, it's crazy to imagine words from our lips as arms of compassion. Mountains crumble with every syllable. Hope can live or die. Raise your thoughts a little higher. Use your words to inspire. Joy will fall like rain when you speak life with the things you say. So speak life. Speak life to the deadest, darkest night. Speak life. Speak life. When the sun won't shine and you don't know why, look into the eyes of the brokenhearted. Watch them come alive as soon as you speak hope. You speak love. You speak life. As I thought about one of those lines, to speak life to the deadest, darkest night, I thought about my God in heaven, who in the very beginning, in the midst of a shroud of darkness and chaos, when everything was disjointed and spread all over the place, when he first made the heavens and the earth, the Spirit of God hovered over the surface of the deep and the darkness. And when it saw, when God the Spirit, when he saw the darkness, he didn't curse it. He said, "Let there be light." He spoke life into existence. And when darkness covered the land in the noon of the day, and on that cross Jesus hung there, and it seemed as if all hope was lost, as he hung on that cross and he whispered, "I thirst." And he said, "Today you will be with me in paradise," to the thief that hung beside him. Jesus knew that in the darkest, the deadest, darkest night, that 3 days later, the God who spoke life into the darkness would speak life into the tomb, and he would be raised to life again. And he would be demonstrated to be the second Adam, come to life, and he would be a life-giving spirit. And he would go forth speaking life into you and me, sending us on a mission to follow in the steps of his resurrection and also be life-giving spirits. Let's go speak life. Tonight, Jesus has a word for you. During his ministry, in John chapter 6, some of his followers began to leave. And in sadness, because Jesus had taught some really hard things to stomach, to understand and to embrace. So Jesus, in sadness, turns to his closest followers and he says, "Will you too leave?" And the answer comes back, "Lord, to whom shall we go? For you have the words of life." Jesus has a word for you. It's a word of life. And he invites you to come to him who is the resurrection and the life. He has the way and the truth and the life that can lead to the Father. And only he can take you there. If you need to come and embrace Jesus as your Lord and Savior, if you want to talk more about it, have a personal study, or you're ready to embrace him, if we can help you or pray for you, come to Jesus and let him speak life into you as we stand and as we sing.